And welcome back, everyone. We're talking with Neil Sanders about mind control, media coercion, social behaviorism, engineering, what have you, all the things that we see in the world running alongside the manipulations agenda, of course. But so many people that we have been talking about now, Neil, have actually been actively involved, if you will, in the coercion. Majority, I think, are doing it knowingly. From the media to the reporters and the editors, the psychologists, the script writers, the politicians, what have you. But I wanted to tie in this other aspect to this and ask you a little bit more about the Manchurian candidate and how real that concept actually is or could be of basically a completely controlled individual that would act and behave in such a way which largely would be unknown to themselves if that's indeed how it operates and how it works. So, yeah. You know, break that down for us a little bit. And if you think that, you know, how accurate is the portrayal that's, you know, done in that movie?
Well, according to the declassified documents, it's frighteningly accurate. There are a number of ways that actions can be coerced. One of them is as is shown in the film, is the use of hypnosis. Now, the thing is about hypnosis is that this could not be done by your average market garden hypnotherapist in the street. The techniques that must have been used, they don't actually talk about it, but I'm a professional hypnotherapist myself. Now, we know that the experiments worked because we've got the documents, and they show that people were giving up declassified information, people were stripping naked and offering themselves up for sex. People were. There was one experiment whereby a woman fired a gun at her friend's face, and both of them had complete amnesia about the entire thing. There are experiments done by Morse Allen whereby people planted bombs or went into areas where they weren't supposed to be in and secreted documents on their person, and you know, for espionage purposes and stuff like that. There were public experiments whereby top secret classified information was extracted by certain by Morse Allen essentially and George Estabrooks. George Estabrooks was another hypnotist, and he was able to create multiple personalities. Basically, his realization was that if you can cure multiple personality or split personality with hypnosis or hypnotherapy, then by reversing the process, you can actually induce it. And he was able to do certain things. For example, he was able to do a hypnotic courier whereby you'd put somebody in trance, you'd give them information and tell them you've got to go to Japan and you've got to do X, Y, and Z and speak to this colonel. And when you speak to this colonel will give you a code word and then you'll give him all this information. So you would be able to impart pages and pages and pages of information into the subconscious mind of this soldier. Then he would have no conscious recollection of it. He goes over to Japan. Colonel Brown says, the moon is clear. And he immediately goes back into trance and starts reeling off all this information. But it's locked in such a way that basically only those two people can extract it, and the soldier himself has no knowledge of it. Yeah. Another experiment that he did was basically creating two personalities within a same person, personality A, personality B. Personality A was a communist. A hardline communist, personality B was the normal American soldier. And so by basically influencing them to go into personality A, they could be used in undercover scenarios. Then they could be brought back into personality B and the information could be extracted hypnotically. And there was certain other experiments whereby people were picking up snakes, putting their hands in acid, throwing beakers of sulfuric acid at complete strangers. And this was all done via hypnosis. But I wish to make this absolutely clear. Like, I mean, the general consensus is that you can't do that with hypnosis, and you can't make anybody do anything that would be against their will. Now, Morse Allen and George Estabrooks would argue with that, and the documents would argue with that. However, it's not quite as simple as that, because there's ways that you could do it, and to do it would require a lot of work and absolutely no scruples. I couldn't do it. No hypnotist that I know could do it, but it can be done. And the way that you do it is there's several ways. You can frame an action so that it's something mundane. For example, Mark Chapman and Sirhan Sirhan both believed that they were at a shooting range, and so they just performed the action of pulling a gun out of their pocket and just shooting straight ahead. In both of those instances, I actually believe that they fired blanks. I think it was a gentleman called Jose Podermo that killed John Lennon, and a gentleman called Eugene Caesar that actually killed Robert Kennedy. But you could do that, so you frame it as something mundane. You could also frame it as something vital. For example, this person's going to murder your family, so if you don't kill them, if you can really implant that belief into the person, that then they would perform an action that they felt was moral. And then the third way that you could do it is you could just basically, and this is the most despicable, is you just create such a rapport and such a caring atmosphere between you and the subject to the point where they believe whatever you tell them to do, you're not going to let them come to harm because you're friends. So I know this hypnotist is telling me to jump off this cliff, and I know it appears that I'm jumping off a cliff or stabbing a person or whatever, but that can't be what's happening because my therapist would never put me in such a situation. And so by those methods, you could actually coerce them. And that's how the acid experiments were done, you know, throwing acid at people's faces. The one where you frame it as something vital, a gentleman called J.G. Watkins basically got soldiers to believe that their commanding officer was a Japanese spy. Mm-hmm. And it worked so well that basically one of them had a penknife hidden in his boot. They didn't know this, and he stabbed the officer. So that worked a little too well. And then the other ones are basically just performing repetitive actions. So that's hypnosis. So that's just one way. Via implants, there were several people. John Lilly was the first person that basically mapped the pleasure centers and the pain centers of the brain. And him and Antoine Raymond were people that were putting the first chips into people's heads. A gentleman called James Olds has actually done experiments on rats in the early 50s or mid-50s. And he basically put pleasure sensors in these rats' brains. And every time they pressed a button, they had an orgasm. And basically, within a week, every single rat in the experiment had died of dehydration because they'd just become fixated on self-abuse.
Wow.
So, you know, if there's any teenage boys listening, be aware it can happen. So, and there was another experiment. It was called B13. It was John Lilly that did that, and essentially they did the same experiment on a human being.
Mm-hmm.
And he had to be forcibly removed from the machine. He pressed the button over 1,000 times in about 20 minutes. So.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Wow.
But so there's those things. And then further to that, Jose Delgado was employing things called Stimosievers. What that does is it's a chip that causes an electrical synapse, and basically it replicates the normal rhythms. You know, like you can get those things where you put them on your stomach and they make your arm flip up.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
electrical like pulses or whatever.
Yeah. It works like that, and by that you can make people do absolutely anything. I mean, the stuff that he was talking about was totally frightening. He was saying that they got it down to a— this is in the 60s. They got it down to about 3 kilometers. So they could do it via radio waves of 3 kilometers. And they could influence thoughts. They could read people's thoughts. They could cause somatic and actions. They could cause any movement of the body that they wanted. And this is all documented. Again, this is in my first book. And he famously spoke before Congress saying that, look, we need to do this. We need to electronically control the military. We need to electronically control the masses. And anybody that deviates from a prescribed norm should be surgically mutilated. And then a lot of his sort of experiments are now actually being used is a thing called transcranial magnetic stimulation.
Yeah. Yep.
They're using that in soldiers at the minute. And what it does is it basically floods them with complicated microwaves. A lot of it's based on the experimentation of a chap called Michael Persinger, who made the God helmet, which essentially changes your reality. It works in the same way. But what is happening on soldiers, it basically allows them to reduce fatigue, it turns them into idiot savants, basically. But then further to that, they're also combining it with a drug called, propalane, which it alleviates guilt. And then the third thing that they're doing is they're wiping the memories of soldiers. And the reason that they're doing this, apparently, is to prevent the possible onset of post-traumatic stress disorder.
Yeah.
But what we've got there is ultra strong guilt-free killing machines.
That's right, exactly. Take away the you know, the responsibility, the repercussions of your actions. I mean, it's terrifying what they're doing.
Thomas Narutta admitted to this in a NATO conference in the 80s, I believe. Could be wrong about that. And he was saying that they were using they're taking people out of military prisons and they were training them to be killers by you know, a combination of drugs, electromagnetic waves, and such like that, and putting them in front of increasingly violent films to the point where they were desensitized, to the point where they could kill somebody on command with absolutely no regret. And they say this was, they were spread out. In various, it was in Naples that he was actually doing it, but they were spread out and they were already in embassies all over the world, apparently. Wow. And that's just some of them. I mean, there's that's not even looking at the microwave things. I mean, there's things like soft kill, slow kill, and silent kill weapons, which obviously, you know, you can give people cancers and stuff like that from a distance. You can explode people's hearts. You can make people's brains hemorrhage. And this was all done by people like Ross Addy oh, what's his name? Frey, Alan Frey, mm-hmm. and people like that. And then you've got even more than that. You've got synthetic telepathy, which was by people like Igor Smirnov, whereby you could put a voice into people's heads. And the one time that they were actually going to do it, but decided not to do it, they got Charlton Heston to record a series of dialogue, and he was going to talk through this machine to the brain of David Koresh at the Waco siege and try and persuade him to end it. But the it's true. It's absolutely true. But the ATF decided it'd be far more humane to set them on fire instead.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good one.
And then the other one this is terrifying. This was a part of a project called Pandora. You noted that you can put an EEG pattern on a microwave or a low frequency wave, and basically, if you fire this, for example, if you feel white hot rage, you would expel a certain frequency and a certain wave pattern, and if you feel depressed, there's another different type of wave pattern. Well, if you can replicate that, put it onto a microwave and fire it at people's brains, bizarrely, the brain cannot tell the difference between that. And the actual real one. It was Ross Addy that was his name. And so the brain thinks that signal is organic, and so responds as it would normally. So, you know, you white hot rage or whatever, you do that, and you have no control over it. There is no way that you can control it. And then there are other things like silent sound, which was Oliver Lowry, and this was used in the first Gulf War. It's played over speakers, it's masked by music, and then there's very, very, very low volume instructions, and basically they'll just tell you to give up. You know, it's hopeless, you're worthless, and you become suicidal. And so when you see all of those Iraqis with their hands over their heads just running across the desert during the first Gulf War, that was because of Silent Sound. This is officially denied by the military, but Silent Sound, the company that actually made the product, on their website, they very proudly mentioned that it was used.
So it seems then, Neil, that, you know, in the beginning you had hypnosis, drugs, trauma-based mind control. I mean, as we know, religion is one of the first, you know, applications, if you will, of mind control, of controlling someone's, you know, beliefs and everything else. But
yes,
it seems to have moved more towards the technological applications in the last few years. You know, now they can, like, remote control rodents. Recently they had this brain...
Oh, that's old. That's the acoustic kitty. They did that in 1955. It cost them about $15 million. This is Subproject 62, I think. I could be wrong about that. But yeah, they're putting mechanisms in cats and dogs and dolphins, like John Lilly was doing. It's dolphins. This is where we get these bomb dolphins from now. They're essentially radio controlled.
That's right.
But they were doing this in, Victor Marchetti, who wrote a book about it, and in that he talks about the acoustic kitty, and it was a real cat, and they stuffed its skull full of microphones, used its tail as an antenna, and gave it remote control legs, and it cost them something like $25 million in the 50s, and the first time they used it, it walked into the road and got hit by a taxi. So, but yeah, that's nothing new. Like, you know,
exactly. It goes from Delgado stuff when he remotely controls, stop the bull in its tracks, exactly, right there. Yeah. But But the application seems to be that this is the way they've gone down. You have this recent article we put out now about researchers actually managed to control one of their colleagues' emotions in a first, you know, brain-to-brain interface. Did you see this piece?
Yes, I did, yeah. And again, that was done by Michael Persinger in the 70s in Laurentian University in Canada, and it was being done in the 60s by Soviets, and it was... It's always strange when they put these things out in the media, because they already exist. It's very strange. Like, and other people will talk about the fact that they'll every so often, every few years, they'll announce that there's microbial life on Mars. It's like, we know, you told this is years ago.
I know. Yeah.
Like, you know, but people can only take on board a certain amount of information. So this is why you have prevalent headlines and stuff like that, because, you know, people forget unless you've got a curiosity in it, I suppose.
So let's see how this, you know, if we move onward from it. Oh, by the way, there's actually one more thing I want to ask you about, and it has a little bit to do with both the accuracy of this, you know, maybe in the past and today. Yep. But it seems like in some cases you have it, you know, as you described earlier, you basically seem to have a variable of free wills inside of the main motive that is to be achieved. Let's say the goal is to murder someone, then, you know, where basically the person obviously can't do anything about this, the final goal, but how they do it, when they do it, you know, seems to be variables. In other cases, could it be that the whole script, if you will, is outlined exactly of where they should go, what they should wear, what time they should wait at the door, etc. You know, see what I'm getting at? Is it? Yeah,
absolutely. I think it's both, to be quite honest. There's some that are very vague. You know, you just need to be there at the time so that you can be seen at the scene, and then others you need to be performing very specific actions. And the Sirhan thing was a very specific action. He spoke to the girl in the polka dot dress. He walked up, he got the gun, took it out, fired it 8 times. Somehow managed to get out 14 bullets. You know, that sort of thing. That's very, very specific in his actions. In other things, you've just got to be there, and, you know, it really depends on the scenario.
It depends. Yeah, they can do all of that. That's what you're saying. Whichever one they want. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I get the impression on the two, the sort of famous Mark Chapman case and the Sirhan case. And I get the impression in both of those, they weren't the actual shooter. They were just there to be seen as the shooter, because it just makes it simpler, doesn't it? If you take one element out of the equation, and you can, you know, everybody's looking at this bloke firing blanks, and you can sneak up behind him and pop him 5 times in the side or whatever.
Yeah. Like,
that's my personal thought on those. When it comes to people like school shootings, you know, Ho Sung-hui or the Columbine kids or stuff like that, that's, again, it's, you could really only speculate, but I would imagine that it's sort of multifaceted, to the point where the kids are mind controlled to an extent. There's obviously other people there that are very possibly mind controlled as well in order to do these aspects. You know, like, I think there's about 6 or 7 shooters in Columbine for a start. And then the control of the media and the explanation to the public and the explanation of the scenario and the reasons behind it and stuff like that, that's a broader mind control project. So for that reason, for example, with Columbine, it was important that they were in black, and it was important that they were in trench coats, and it was important that they were on certain websites and talking about KMF, MDM and Rammstein and certain bands like that. And then other things basically get linked onto it, like Marilyn Manson was demonized off the back of that, despite the fact that they didn't actually like his music, you know. But it was that connection with the black clothes and stuff like that. So again, you know, it's multifaceted. But these are intelligence operations. You know, I mean, these people are good at what they do. Like, for the very reason that they get away with the majority of things. Otherwise, we wouldn't be doing this on a fringe thing. We'd, you know, this, everybody would be saying, "We know this, Neil. Why are you telling us this?" So, you know, it is multifaceted. It is very complicated, and it's very, very well planned and thought out.
Okay, so one more point here before we move on to the hippie movement. Sure. Sirhan, as you said, there was, I mean, he recently, we posted the story back in 2011 when he basically talked about how he was, you know, seduced by a girl, as you said, in the polka dot dress. He was, you know, even at this, he was involved in a mind control you know, plot that she had, like, you know, led him to fire the gun and everything and lead him to the ambassador hotel, blah, blah, blah. The, you know, documents have been coming out about this. So that you have this kind of honeypot, you know, scenario. There seems to be a very attractive girl involved. And what does that element do or add to this?
Well, I mean, she ran down the stairs, didn't she, with her father carrying a rifle, shouting, "We shot him, we shot him, we shot Kennedy." And some people have taken that to be some sort of a confession, like, so. But I mean, she basically performed the action, the post-hypnotic control that put him into a state. That's what she did. Who was the guy? What's his name? I'm just looking for it here. William Joseph Bryan, that was the guy. He was part of MKUltra. He was the hypnotist that it is alleged was involved in programming Sirhan Sirhan. And he was also the person that managed to coerce the confession from the Boston Strangler. You know, some of these confessions, some of the Boston Strangler, some of the crimes, he wasn't even in the state at the time. You know, that is what you call a confession. Like, you know, you really, really went to town with that one. Interestingly, like, for no good reason, Sirhan Sirhan kept writing down the name Albert DeSalvo and such like that. But, yeah, you can use all sorts of things, honeypot. I mean, there was a very famous one called, this was one of the early experiments, just by George Hunter White. It was called Operation Climax. It was set up in a brothel. Obviously, basically, because these people were going, you know, brought into there by these prostitutes and then slipped LSD. And then, you know, they were viewed behind a two-way mirror. And so that's a perfect example of a honeypot. Interestingly, where they learned how to slip LSD into people's drinks was from a guy called John Mulholland. He's not particularly well known now, but he was a world-famous magician. He was the equivalent of, like, David Blaine or David Copperfield or one of these guys. And he taught the CIA and wrote a manual about sleight of hand techniques, specifically how to slip LSD into people's drinks.
Wow. So let's talk a little bit more about the CIA when they got involved in LSD, you know, from Hoffman up to the 60s and the whole shebang up to the hippie movement. Let's just into it.
Well, LSD is basically, that's important to the whole MKUltra and Mind Control thing, because that's how we found out about it. It was a gentleman called Frank Olson. Frank Olson was a senior biochemist. He worked directly with Sidney Gottlieb. Sidney Gottlieb was the head of the Technical Service Division, or the Department of Potions and Tricks, which is what ran MKUltra. And he was involved in aerosolizing LSD, and he was very probably involved in aerosolizing anthrax. There was one experiment in Pont Saint-Esprit in 1951 that looks very much like the CIA sprayed a cloud of LSD onto the village, and, you know, to test it. They did it in San Francisco, and they did it in the subway system in New York. But also, basically, the aerosolizing of anthrax was used in the Korean War. And this is where you got all the confessions, where basically all these pilots were standing up and saying, yeah, we use chemical weapons and we denounce America. What's strange is that was basically the premise by E. Howard Hunt wrote the book saying, look, all these people have been mind controlled. What later came out was that all these people were told to do that, to give the premise that they'd been mind controlled and then allow the response and to demonize them. Actually, the MKUltra and Chatter and Bluebird started before the Korean War started. So, one's completely out of the window. But basically, he was involved in this and he started to get a bit twitchy with it. He saw one experiment went wrong. It didn't work. And so these guys were taken around the back of an aircraft hangar and told to dig their own graves and then shot in the back of the head. And, you know, he ultimately, this left a bad taste in his mouth, if you'll excuse the pun. And Sidney Gottlieb slipped him some LSD, and it just sent him barking. And then about 2 weeks later, they threw him out of the window of the Statler Hilton Hotel. It was actually George Hunter White that threw him out the window. And this came out in 1977. Ted Kennedy brought it to the Senate, and this is where you get the majority of the MKUltra documents. And then John D. Marks wrote the Search for the Manchurian Candidate, and he got some as well. What's stupid about that is that basically Ted Kennedy, it takes about 4 minutes of looking at it to see he's as corrupt as they come. He was involved with the mafia, he was involved in bootlegging the Irish mafia, and it seems very, very coincidental that around this time LSD, well, certainly by that time LSD was an illegal drug, and so through the sort of crime syndicates like the mafia with the help of the CIA, he must have known about all of this. Do you know what I mean? And so he's not the the crusading hero that he's actually supposed to be. But I mean, the CIA got into LSD very, very early in about, when was it? In the early, 1953, they basically, Sandoz, as you know, Albert Hoffman invented it, or didn't invent it, he managed to find the precursors for it. But in 1953, I believe, the CIA tried to buy 10 kilograms of LSD, which, you know, a gram is 10,000 doses, so that's quite a lot that they were trying to get hold of, but they weren't able to make that amount. It was about 40 grams had only ever been made. And so after that, they went to Eli Lilly and basically got them to synthetically manufacture LSD. And so all the LSD that you've got since about 1955, it's not pure LSD made from ergot mold. It's actually a synthetic version of LSD.
That's right, yeah.
And then, you know...
Is that significant in any way? Does that... maybe because I believe that whatever you create synthetically is not going to be as the organic natural version of it. And that could even be part of... maybe why, you know, some of the behavior, et cetera. I don't know. What do you think?
I don't know. I know that certain, I mean, we'll get onto this, certain strains of LSD, particularly Orange Sunshine, Monterey Purple and such like that, with Owsley Gold, were very, very strong. And they were, mixed with amphetamines and mixed with certain other things to give them certain effects, not always positive. And these were manufactured by, this is where we get onto the so-called LSD cooks, because and the Johnny Appleseeds, the people that promoted it, every single one of them, absolutely every single one of them, without they're all connected to the military industrial complex.
I mean, L. Hubbard, yeah.
Yeah, Alfred Hubbard was OSS, and he worked for Teledyne. He moved the uranium through for the Manhattan Project through one of their through Port Radium. I mean, that he's that connected to it.
Yeah.
He was the person that basically got Timothy Leary, sort of promoted Timothy Leary, got him in touch with the William Hitchcock Mellon, the Mellon banking family, and then through them, they met Owsley Stanley. Owsley Stanley was the person that was making huge amounts of it. And then Owsley Stanley was also the manager of the Grateful Dead. Then Timothy Leary, Harry Murray. He was his mentor, and he was an OSS officer that was basically at the very foundation of LSD interrogation experiments, and then went on to teach Timothy Leary at Harvard. Timothy Leary got the majority of his LSD from two people: Michael Hollingshead, who's an MI6 agent, and Frank Baran, who was a CIA agent. And he's also good friends with Cord Meyer, who was one of the chief CIA officers behind Project Mockingbird.
You know, the connections around in this whole time frame, this whole movement are just, I mean, they're beyond astonishing. You could just sit for months and just weed them all out, you know, from government, CIA, to the counterculture heroes that was basically there put in place. But people, of course, again, have a cognitive dissonance in this part here, because they, wait a minute, no, you know, Timothy Leary was anti-government. He was speaking against the CIA and all the crimes that they were doing. You
I'll
know,
I'll give you some quotes if you
sure,
like.
Sure, yeah. Go ahead.
About his, he loved the CIA. If you look back at many of the things we thought were accidents, turned out they were not accidents. The entire LSD movement itself was sponsored originally by the CIA, to whom I give great credit. I would not be here today if it had not been for the foresight and prestige of the CIA. So give the CIA the credit for being truly an intelligence agency. Of course they were. I would say that 80% of my movements, 80% of the decisions I made were suggested to me by CIA people. I like the CIA. The game they're playing is better than the FBI, better than the Saigon police, better than Franco's police. So it comes down to who you're going to work for, the Yankees or the Dodgers. Some people have taken that to be some sort of a confession. Like, but again, you know, when he was put in prison, he was broken out by the weatherman. Now, the Weathermen were another one of these left-wing organizations. Transpired again that they were the people that actually they were infiltrated. You know, they were one of these sort of rabble-rousing people to take away from genuine political movements like the Black Panthers and the like. What's interesting is that the sort of one of the death, there were several death knells for the concept of the 60s, Altamont, which obviously went very, very badly, the bust of the Rolling Stones, which was done by David Schneiderman, who was a CIA agent working at the behest of the FBI. And they were all connected with Orange Sunshine. And then the other one was the Orange Sunshine was a particularly strong type of LSD made by Owsley Stanley, financed by the CIA through Timothy Leary and the Brotherhood of Eternal Love. The Brotherhood of Eternal Love was also run by a chap called Ronald Stark. Ronald Stark was a confirmed CIA agent. Sorry to digress, but the interesting thing about the Weathermen, the Weather Underground, was that essentially they were the people that politicized the Manson trial. And the Manson trial was another thing that was a death knell for the 60s, because it forever tied that concept of hippies and communal living and free love to murder. Now, it's a complicated issue, the Manson thing, because like MKUltra and the CIA run through it, but not in the ways that people think. I don't believe that he was actually the mind control guru that he was, but he was utilized afterwards. For example, at his trial, it basically took about a year for it to come to trial, and he was refused a scissors and a razor for that entire time. He never really had long hair or a particularly bushy beard, except for one photo taken in early 1968 where he'd been in the desert for a week. But they presented him with a long beard and with long hair so that he looked like Jesus. And then they came up with this concept that he called himself Christ, which is not true. That was basically, there was a chap that lived on the ranch called Jesus, like Christopher G. They called him Christopher Jesus. It's a joke, get it? Christopher. And he was also called Zero. He was later murdered by Bruce Davis in the cover-up for the whole thing. It's very, very complicated and convoluted. But yeah, they turn up looking for Jesus, and says, is Jesus here? And says, no. He says, what's your name? And he says, my name's Manson. He says, Manson, son of man, that'll do. Get in the back of the car, you're Jesus. And so he was booked under the name Jesus, and that was later played out. You know, the other thing was that his middle name was, he changed his name to all the time because he had fake IDs. And on one of his, he put Charles Willis Manson. And Big Bugliosi said, who was, by the way, a mafia agent, said, look, Charles Will is man's son. He says he's Jesus. It's garbage. It's absolute garbage. The majority of the stuff to do with Manson is garbage. Helter Skelter, this race war thing, the fact that Manson is considered, and don't get me wrong, I'm not an apologist for Manson. Again, it's just a lot of the things are not true.
Mm-hmm.
Helter Skelter is nonsense. He was good friends in prison with Geronimo Pratt. There was a guy, and excuse my language issues, he was called Super Spade. He was a black member of the Manson family. Juan Flynn was foreign. Gypsy was Jewish. Like, you know, it's ridiculous when you actually go through it. They were actually friends with Bernard Crowe, Lots of Popper. Like, that's one of the things. They all knew each other. What's his name? Tex Watson used to live at El Cielo Drive before the Polanskis moved in. So the concept, and he knew Jay Sebring. Jay Sebring was his dealer. And the other girl, Rosemary LaBianca, was also his LSD dealer. It's all tied in with the CIA and motorcycle gangs and straight Satans and Hollywood and Brother Records and laundering of mafia money and cocaine distribution and stuff like that. It's ludicrous. Like, but what happened was it was politicized by the Weather Underground. The lady whose name escapes me at the minute came out and said, dig it. Manson is a political prisoner. They killed those wealthy, rich pigs. They ate dinner in the same room and they even left a fork in his stomach. And they said that 1969 was dedicated to Charles Manson, and it was called the Year of the Fork. They were the people that politicized Charles Manson and got him involved with the youth movement. And so do you see what I mean? It's a very, very clever manipulation of the public perception.
So this goes back to what we talked about earlier as well in the first hour of how you rig the game. You basically have the controllers, and then you have the opposition and the counterculture to that, and in... Or we in the same scenario here that basically if there were any true sentiments around in the 60s to, question authority or what have you, you know, it's very important to get in early on and rig that, channel that energy, if you will, that grassroots movement's enthusiasm into something completely different.
That's the point of the Grateful Dead, who, by the way, were managed by Owsley Stanley. Like, an FBI memo came out in 1968 saying, do not ever, ever, ever stop the Grateful Dead unless we have already given you prior reason to do so, because they're CIA assets. They are employed to move the children away from politicization and towards mysticism and drugs.
Well, what is his name? Garcia, whatever, from Grateful Dead. He was hanging out at Bohemian Grove.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and he was another one that came from the military. I mean, he basically spent a year in the military. I don't know how he got in because he was 17, so he was too young to do it. But he was AWOL the entire time and for some reason didn't actually receive any punishment for it. I mean, David Crosby came from a family of incredibly high-ranking politicians and Freemasons and stuff like that. Jimi Hendrix's manager was an MI6 agent. Jimi Hendrix's manager, Michael Jeffrey, is the person that murdered Jimi Hendrix. You know, all of them. You know, the obvious one is Jim Morrison. Jim Morrison's father was Admiral Stephen Morrison, officer on deck for the Gulf of Tonkin incident.
Mm-hmm.
Strangely, he doesn't talk about that in his music. Like, yeah. And Morrison's hair was done by Jay Sebring. Now, Jay Sebring's other clients, again, just to sort of like digress, were Frank Sinatra, whose toupee he fixed, Steve McQueen, and bizarrely, Yul Brynner would go to his shop about twice a week. For people that don't know, Yul Brynner is as bald as a cue ball.
That's right.
Yeah, see, Jay Sebring's other nickname was the Candyman. And as we previously discussed, he was one of the chief Genovese mafia peddlers and of cocaine. He dealt to all those particular people and to Kennedy, Peter Lawford, Marilyn Monroe, and various other entities within that milieu, shall we say.
Right.
Frank Zappa's another one. Frank Zappa, you know, he grew up on Edgware Arsenal. His father was one of the people that was manufacturing the drugs for MK Ultra. Joan Baez, his father was also doing similar things. He was working at Cornell with the Human Ecology Fund, which is MK Ultra. You know, John Phillips of Mamas and the Papas. He's spent his entire life at military prep schools. He eventually married Susan Adams, and her father was John. She's a descendant of John Adams, you know, the founding father and stuff like that. And John's mother worked in the Pentagon, and his sister worked in the Pentagon. And mysteriously, they all went to the same school as Jim Morrison and all moved there at the same time. Mama Cass was good friends with the Manson family. Like, I mean, this is crazy. Like, Susan Atkins, or Sadie, which, you know, Sadie Mae Glutzfield, whatever you want to call her, they were mates. I mean, the Manson family used to stay at Mama Cass's house quite a lot of the time because basically she was a big druggie. And, you know, Susan was friends with her. She tried to help her lose weight by, you know, going on a week-long amphetamine binge. Billy Doyle, which was her sometime boyfriend, sometime drug dealer, he was one of the chief suspects. Him and Billy Reinhart and Pick Dawson, they were Canadian drug dealers that were sort of also around that scene. And they were the people, Mama Cass phoned the police and said, I think they killed Sharon Tate and the other people. Because, you know, where it said pig, they thought it said pig. Now, the motive was that Billy Doyle had sold Wojtek Fokowski a load of bad MDA. Wojtek Fokowski sold that bad MDA to two people that might be familiar to people who know about the Manson case, Linda Kasabian and Tex Watson.
Mm-hmm.
Like, so, you know, the very concept that, oh, I've never been there before. Oh, poor Linda Kasabian's daughter is now called Lady Dangerous. Linda Kasabian spent the rest of her life doing exactly the same thing, going around ripping off drug dealers. She's a vicious, vicious character, she is. Like, but basically what happened is Billy Doyle had sold them, voiced out this bad dope. He'd sold it off to Tex. Tex had complained, blah-de-blah, but he told him basically a tough look. But he was embarrassed, and so he invited Billy Doyle over and tied him to a tree outside on Roman Polanski's lawn and raped him. And this was filmed, and Dennis Hopper was there, and I believe Peter Sellers was there as well. And then, you know, you find out that other stuff happened. Like, the police found loads of porno tapes at the Polanski house, one that involved Sharon and the chauffeur, and one that involved the chauffeur and a dog, and one that involved Peter Sellers and Yul Brynner, and one that apparently involved Warren Beatty and Susan Atkins, although that could be, that's debated, that one.
But, so these are documented by the police that found these?
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So what the hell is this all about then? You know, I mean, you have the Polanski kind of pseudo satanic connections. You have the, you know, these.
That was basically Bugliosi's trip. So what happened really was this. It was a drug deal gone wrong. Tex went up there, killed, basically to go and steal the money. And this was off the back of the Bobby Bosley killing and Bobby Beausoleil got into a situation where he owed a serious amount of money to the straight Satans, particularly Danny DiCarlo, who, by the way, was one of the chief prosecution witnesses. Danny DiCarlo is probably the person that actually killed Gary Hinman, or if it wasn't him, Bobby Beausoleil killed him because he was terrified of Danny DiCarlo. Off the back of that, basically, that debt was then owed to Bobby. That debt was passed on to Tex because Charles Manson had gone. Tex was a drug dealer. He went around ripping people off. And one of the people that he ripped off was lots of Papa Bernard Crow. So Manson went over there to rescue a girl that was basically being held captive, got into a tussle and shot Bernard Crow, thought that, and so thought he killed him, but actually hadn't. And so Tex owed all this money and needed to get some money, basically. And so he went there to rob Jay Sebring. They didn't think Sharon was going to be there, a producer, a very famous Hollywood producer who's still alive, so I won't mention his name, phoned to check that she was going to be, that she wasn't going to be there. She was going to go and stay at a friend's house. The name of the actress escapes me, but this is on record. She was going to go to a friend's house, but then about 11:30 at night, 15 minutes before the people turned up to do the drug deal, she changed her mind. Her car wasn't there. It was in the shop. So basically, when Tex and that turned up, they thought it was fine. They didn't break into the house. They were let into the house. This is proven by the actual scenario because there were 7 glasses found at the scene. So, you know, they were offered drinks by their hosts. They were good friends. Mm-hmm. It all went wrong. Sharon got killed. Jay got killed. They robbed the drugs. They went over to try and take the rest of the drugs from Jay's house. Went back, realized it was a complete cluster. So Manson and a few people went back to the house to try and clear it up and move the bodies around and such like that. The next night, Tex had found out that basically he wanted to get some LSD as well. Steve McQueen very nearly turned up as well. That's an interesting side. He wanted to get some LSD as well, and his dealer was Rosemary LaBianca. Now, he just discovered that Rosemary was cutting him out of the deal and selling to Jay at a much, much reduced price. And so he was fairly angry. It's a bit convoluted and complicated what happened with the LaBiancas, because basically there is a suggestion. Lino LaBianca, he owed about $250,000 to the Genovese crime syndicate, and he also had in his possession a document book that listed customers within Hollywood. Now, Manson went and got that book back. Whether that was a part of a blackmail plot that Lino was trying against the mafia, or whether that was Manson doing a favor for the mafia to get it back because he was friends with Frank Costello and Alvin Creepy Karpis and various people like that. He actually ran cocaine for the mafia at various times and got that's how he was playing certain music things, because Nick Grillo was connected to the mafia, and that's how he got connected to Dennis Wilson and people like that. What's interesting about the LaBianca, the things that we know is that the reason the boat was left outside and the reason she had her dress on over the top of her nightgown was they took Rosemary to her shop, which is where she kept her entire stash, then took them back, and then they killed them back at the home. A lot of this stash was sold. It was taken by Bruce Davis over to Manchester, actually, and sold through various IRA contacts. But again, that's a very other story. Now, here's where it gets very strange with the LaBianca things, because a lot of gold coins, he collected gold coins, and these were basically being found in various places. And a lot of them were found at the Manson Ranch. The suggestion is that Lino, because they were dealing with the Manson family and because they were actually, known to each other and business associates, and he owed this money, he was allowing himself to be burgled on a regular basis. They were getting rid of this money. He was collecting the insurance, and this was a way of paying off his enormous gambling debts, or this was a time. So this is very possibly why he was tied up so easily, because he thought, oh, okay, it's just another one of these scenarios. Brilliant. Okay, we've arranged this. This is where it gets even stranger. The Bianca's daughter, well, Rosemary's daughter, was called Susan, and she lived across the road from Tex Watson. She was friends with him, and mm-hmm. her boyfriend was a chap called Joe Dorgan. Joe Dorgan was a straight Satan and a member of the Manson family. Now, they were the people that actually found the bodies, and she was the chief beneficiary of $2 million will. You know, Rosemary LaBianca was actually wealthier than Abigail Folger, and Abigail Folger was mega wealthy, despite the fact that Rosemary LaBianca was just, she ran a wig shop. You know, Tex ran a shop as well, and Jay ran a hairdresser's. For some reason, the hair industry is used for the movement of drugs.
That's interesting. Yeah, it seems like it. As you said before, was this the other name, the hairdresser?
Jay Sebring.
Yeah, that's right, Sebring.
I mean, Jay Sebring, basically, if Jay Sebring hadn't have died, it would have been Sebring rather than Vidal Sassoon, because Vidal Sassoon basically... No, seriously.
Yeah,
into his place. He was that successful, and he was that, you know, influential within the scene. As I say, he coiffured Steve McQueen and Sinatra and the whole Rat Pack and the whole Laurel Canyon scene, particularly Jim Morrison and the rest of the Doors. You know, he made their image. But what was really strange was that later Susan, she went to court, and she's very active in trying to get Tex out. She claimed that she never knew him. But then it came out that basically, hang on, didn't you used to live with him? Like, basically. And so she's been actively sort of campaigning at his parole to get Tex out. So that sort of lends credence to the possibility that she had in some way hired Tex to off her mother so that she got all this money.
Wow. I mean, there's so many bizarre, you know, relationships and connections between in this era as well, as we said before.
I mean, the other one that people would talk about is Manson's sort of fascination with the Beatles, which again is nonsense. You know, all this sort of Revelation 9 and, you know, the four men with women's with hair like women whose breastplates are fire and this is their guitars and stuff like that. This was made up by Susan Atkins and Little Paul Watkins and sometimes Squeaky, but it was nothing more than a crazy sort of acid trip. You know, they were just chatting about it. He wasn't particularly a big fan of the Beatles. He liked Bing Crosby and artists like that. If you listen to Manson's albums, they don't actually sound anything like the Beatles at all, you know. Mm-hmm. And if he was such a huge fan, why on earth did he not do that? Interestingly, the Masonic cover of Abbey Road was taken at the exact same time that the Tate murders were happening. My thought about it is, and this is only a thought, but Manson wrote at least two songs for the Beach Boys, at least two songs, right? Okay. He was actually offered a record contract with Brother Records, as was Bobby Beausoleil. If that hadn't worked out, Neil Young had tried to get him on at Warner Brothers with Mo Austin, and they were desperate to sign him, but he was already signed to Brother Records. And this all went wrong when basically Bobby killed Gary and he shot Bernard Lotsepopper, because they were like, look, we can't do anything now. And this is where you get this nonsense that he was angry at the music industry and stuff like that. Doris Day's son, Terry Melcher, he was all a plot to kill Terry Melcher. That's nonsense. He'd met Terry Melcher and was seen driving around in Terry Melcher's car after the Tate murders. Like, he knew Terry Melcher did move. Like, as I say, the people that lived in El Cielo before the Polanskis moved in were Dean Morehouse and Tex Watson. They actually lived in the bat house where William Garrison moved in. But the point was they were familiar with the property. Like, as I say, Rudy Outerbelly, like, who was the owner of the property, they dealt with Manson and Sharrock as well, the Iranian person that lived there. They bought marijuana off each other and stuff like that. It was a whole big sort of cottage industry of drug dealers. And so, again, it's absolutely nonsense. But here's my thought of that. Because of the connection to the Beach Boys and because of the connection, the murders essentially, the cover-up was there to hide, A, the connection to drugs and the music industry and the film industry, B, the connection with drugs to the mafia, but more than that, the connections of the mafia to the CIA.
Right.
Do you know, because there's no way that this, like, the mafia could operate like that without the CIA. It's just, it's impossible. And there is proof of that that I will come out with later. Not today, but I'm writing a book about it in a minute. Okay. But anyway, because of his connection to the Beach Boys, it would have been disastrous. It should have been disastrous for the Beach Boys. Why wasn't it? Because suddenly all of it was flipped onto their rivals, the Beatles. And the Beatles at the same time were basically talking about, you know, we're not touring anymore, all you need is love, la-di-blah-di-blah, et cetera, et cetera. And they were becoming a problem for the establishment. So, it's, you know, it kills two birds with one stone. In my opinion, I think that's certainly worth looking at. The concept of tying Manson to the Beatles was there to actually protect the Beach Boys.
So, you know, you talked about some of the connections to the other things. Is this ultimately about controlling? I mean, there's so many aspects to this, but the music industry, the musicians, you get them hooked on drugs, dependent. You have usually a very staunch, you know, manager in there that are managing these people.
Yeah, absolutely. You always see often the managers like Nick Grillo and Michael Jeffrey and stuff like this were all connected, Owsley Stanley, and all these people were connected to Mafia, CIA, or the intelligence agencies, like in some way. The whole point of this sort of the LSD scenario was, again, to sort of the bands were to move people away from politicization, provide them with sort of channels that seem like authentic heroes and stuff like that, but actually not really do anything in it. And also, as I say, it was a huge experiment. There were loads and loads of CIA agents in the Laurel Canyon, Haight-Ashby area, Jolly West and various people. Certain documents have come out that suggests that at that time the entire area was being used as a large guinea pig farm, like an experiment, a social experiment to see what you can do and how you can manipulate people. And this was done through sex and drugs and rock and roll. And that's the thing. The whole other point is you immediately criminalize a whole swathe of society. I mean, the guy that he was Harry Anslinger that was actually. He was the person that made marijuana illegal, and he was instrumental in making LSD illegal. And he was doing true serum experiments at St. Elizabeth's Hospital in Washington using those exact same substances, and it immediately criminalizes people. Jolly West wrote a paper about how drugs can be used to either get people addicted, to turn them into lotus eaters, you know, to get them to completely disconnect from the world, or to alternatively just provide a reason to lock people up, and then, you know, you get money from the prison industrial complex, that person's ruined for the rest of, you know, because you can't get a decent job once you've got a criminal record. And these are all, again, very well thought out societal control systems.
But there's a very kind of, political, established ideology, if you will, that kind of goes hand in hand with this as well. If we think, for example, of the modern, the current psychedelic movement, and again, go back and consider the roots of this, what do you think about this? Is this, good stuff or?
Well, it can be. It's all right. You know, each their own, to be quite honest.
Yep.
But, I mean, this is it. Where did you get the publicization of it? Gordon Wasson talking about it in Life magazine. He's Subproject 58. Aldous Huxley, connections to Tavistock. I appreciate we've run out of time, but we've not even had a chance to talk to Aldous Huxley and his connections to Aleister Crowley and his connections to Tavistock and Timothy Leary and all these people. And Timothy Leary himself, Terence McKenna. I mean, Terence McKenna would appear to be unwitting, but he was certainly utilized to publicize the concept of psychedelia. Yeah. And just to tie it back to Manson, Manson was one of the... He read that article in Life magazine, and so he went down to Mexico, and he couldn't find the Mazatecs. He couldn't find them, but so he went and found the equally or the even more obscure Yaqui tribe and did peyote and mushroom experiments with them. But... Where did they get this concept from it? Where did you get the concept prior to that of the beatnik? You know, Allen Ginsberg and all these people, Jack Kerouac, where are they taking all their drugs? Well, a lot of them are getting it from Michael Hollingshead, MI6 agent.
Yeah, I mean, we have, I remember that one clip with Allen Ginsberg talking about how, it was an accident that the CIA released all the, all the drugs and everything.
Of course it was. It was an accident that released STP and BZ and all these, phencyclidine and stuff like that. They all appeared. Yeah. They were all made by Owsley Stanley. Now, Owsley Stanley could have only got that recipe from one place, which was Edgware Arsenal. So, they weren't released by accident. They're released on purpose. And I get the impression that ecstasy was a more recent example of that, particularly in England. It managed to criminalize a huge amount of people and turn people onto sort of free parties and stuff like that. And just about the time that basically it looked to be very powerful, and coincidentally, football violence just completely dropped because everybody was pilled up, and so they were hugging each other rather than smashing beer bottles into each other's faces.
Well, there is such a sentiment that actually argues, and I mean, some of these elite higher ups people are like this, that all right, you know, human beings are violent by nature. Unfortunately, they're tribal. But, you know, if there is a way, like Huxley and, you know, some of his peers, to that we can manage and control mankind with the right chemicals, it's all right to do so, to pacify them, yeah, to make them more peaceful, right?
Well, exactly. That's the oldest Huxley thing. There's no reason we can train people to love their servitude, and under a pharmacological dictatorship, there's no reason that it should fail.
Right.
But coincidentally, about that time, the quality of ecstasy started dropping off, and the football violence went back. Now ecstasy's back in a big way. It's called Molly now. It's the same thing. It's just MDMA. But now it's sold on sexuality. Like, initially it was sold on love and dancing. Now it's a sex drug. And it's also been sort of subtly marketed as a date rape drug as well, which is in songs like You Ain't Even Know It by Rick Ross and other things like that. but you know what I mean? I don't think it's an accident that these things, like in England, I don't know if it was the same in Europe, we had a sort of a rush of legal highs like methadone and MCAT and all these stuff. I didn't know these existed until there was an article in the Daily Mail saying, for God's sake, don't touch this, or this particular celebrity took this, or this is it.
And then the kids are like, whoa, really? They don't want you to touch this. Huh? Let's do it, you know? Of course.
Just go on YouTube right now and watch, like, when the crack epidemic started in America. There's a new form of highly addictive, incredibly powerful, cheap drug. And it's like, really? Where did you get this? Well, this is available on the street corners in various cities. Really?
In your area right now.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. There was one in the Daily Mail a couple of weeks ago. It says, don't take these pink ecstasy tablets. They're so strong and cheap that they could kill you.
I refuse to believe, I mean, sincerely, that they don't understand reverse psychology. I mean, 101, for Christ's sake. What the hell?
Exactly. You know? Exactly. What is it that fascinates you about my forbidden box of wonder?
Like, yeah, exactly. Yeah. What's in the box? Yeah. Do you want to try? You know, yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, it's understandable that they know how to achieve it. They know how to market it right, you know, and they understand, you know, the youth's instinctive energy of rebellion, and therefore, you know, okay, let's channel it in the right way. Let's do this.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and again, a lot of it ties back to sort of conspicuous consumption of fatuous nonsense, basically. Like, and status symbols for status symbols' sake. You know, a lot of the talismans that people would wear, then that's the whole point of them. That they have no purpose or use. All this jewelry, it's peacock feathers, isn't it? It's like, you know, but that's the point. You're building your existence on insignificant stuff that has no substance.
So what do you make of it today, if we look at it, and how accurate is these techniques that they have implemented? How well managed is it at this stage? Is it, I mean, are we living in a completely, the majority I'm talking about now, of youth and everything else, in an engineered bubble, if you will, of...
Well, Justin Bieber continues to sell.
Sure does.
And Lady Gaga continues to sell. And yet my music stays on the shelf. So I
say, that's right. So, I don't have an axe to grind. No, but I mean, it's garbage. Let's be honest about that. Most of it is garbage. The lyrics are, there's nothing in there. It's just formula, you know, and that's it.
It's pleasant. I mean, that's the thing. Like, it's brilliantly constructed garbage. It's earworms and stuff like that. Like Lady Gaga's album, there's about 14 different songwriters and producers for every single track. It's like a science experiment. They know what they're doing. Like, they really do know how to tap into melody and rhythm to physically affect you. So it's not as easy to say, oh, she's rubbish. Like, I don't understand why people are into it. I totally understand why people are into it. It doesn't make it right. A lot of people like Coldplay. Doesn't make it right. A lot of people voted for Hitler. It doesn't make it right. And do you know what I mean? So this is the point. It's very powerful a lot of the time because people aren't looking for it. And they don't, particularly entertainment and heroes and artists and television programs and anything that they assume that it is fluff. Because it's there. This is what's frightening about it, is that basically your guard's down. Because it's your leisure time. But these people, they're not stupid. They understand that basically you need to be exhausted all day and either repeating stuff at school or at work and stressed out and stuff like that. And in your leisure time, you need to be filled up with rubbish as well. Because, you know, I forget exactly the quote. It's a George Carlin quote. It's for people, we need people that are just bright enough to operate machinery, but just dumb enough to not realize how badly they're being treated.
Yeah, that's right.
And to do that, I mean, an example, it works in the same way. Why do they play music in shops? Right, they're playing music because your brain's got a finite bandwidth. Okay, you can only take in so much information. So if you've got all these colors and screaming kids and you're looking for bargains and there's all these different advertising techniques and stuff going on again, and then just to top it off, the shopping center's in a confusing layout and it all looks the same, and I'm pretty sure I've been here 3-4 times before, and then there's music playing and it's pretty annoying music and it's just inane going...
That just makes me want to, you know, run out of there quickly.
Well, that's because you're reacting to it. But the other way to do it is to just, you go, you surrender to it, and then all of a sudden you walk out with armfuls of stuff and you forgot what you actually went there to get. but it's the same principle on a societal basis. You know, mm-hmm. they've got to fill your mind with mush, because if you've got empty spaces, it's the concept behind advertising, it's the concept behind news media and fear. It's the you've got to fill that gap, because the second that gap's empty, you look to fill it with something.
So there's much more to the story, of course. In the meantime, we'll relay people further to the two volumes that you do have. Your thoughts are not your own, and you guys out there listening can get to it via Neil Sanders, mindcontrol.com. What's next for you? You're working on something new, you said. What's that about?
I'm sort of tentatively working on a book about Manson, and to try and to sort of, you know, explain that a bit clearly. And I possibly have a plan to do some DVDs of the talks that I've done, and I'll be doing some talks around. And if anyone wants to get in touch with me, you know, to do any talks or anything like that, you know, I'm very happy to do so. So, and we'll just see what happens, basically.
Really good. Well, it's a big subject. It's great talking with you, Neil. Thank you so much for coming on the program. So keep up the good work, and I hope we can do it again at some point.
I'd be delighted. It was an absolute pleasure, and thank you very, very much for having me.
We have much more coming on Red Ice Radio. Cliff High, Anthony Peake, Neil Kramer, Jared Andringa, and Phil Stanford. But before any of those, we have a Radio 314 next, an interview with William Patterson on Gurdjieff, his teachings, and the fourth wave. My thanks to Frederick, Lana, Elizabeth, and John, and a special thanks to you for being a member. Have a great day, and we'll speak to you in just a few days.